Hey, we're talking with Fred Whitehurst, who is a criminal defense attorney and forensic scientist in Bethel, North Carolina. He's a former FBI explosives expert with a PhD in chemistry, and in 1997 made headlines when he revealed questionable practice at the FBI laboratory. But we're talking with him today about Dong Thuy Tram's journal and diary. How did you find this diary? Take us back to the point when you discovered this diary.
Well, I was in a position in the U.S. Army in Duc Pho, Quang Ngai province in the Vietnam War, where I reviewed documents that we got from the field. And the documents that didn't appear to have any military, be of any military benefit, we just burned them. There were so many of them that we just put them in a big old 55-gallon drum and burned them. And these particular document had come from the field with other stuff. And as I was burning documents, the interpreter who was working with me, Nguyen Trung Hieu, over my shoulder said, "Fred, don't burn this one. It has fire in it already." And it was a very, emotional kind of a statement.
How did the translator, in the few moments between finding a document, looking at a document, and tossing it in the fire, know that the document was so rich?
Oh, sir, if you read the diary, you'll know it almost immediately. I mean, within a page or two, that you're reading the words of somebody very special.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood there, and I saw him when he was standing there reading the diary. I thought it was more out of curiosity than anything else. And he stood there for about, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, while I was tearing up papers, burning them. And so he had plenty of time to read her words to understand that Dong Thuy Tram was a special person.
He told you about this, and then what did he do to make it clear to you that he had found something unusual?
Well, I had a lot of respect for Nguyen Trung Hieu. He was a very patriotic soldier. He was, of course, fighting for the Saigon government. And that he would say this to me in the face of possible repercussions from his own command. If we were caught doing this, it meant, my goodness, there must be something special, because Hieu didn't owe anything to a communist soldier, to a soldier from the North. Besides respecting Hieu as a person, anyhow, just the fact that he would come out and say that said, we need to stop this burning. We need to stop this process with that particular item.
And what transpired after that? You took the document with you?
Yes. What happened was, that was December of 1969. I didn't go home till April of 1972, and we'll save this one. And I took it inside the tent and laid it aside. And that evening, under the one light bulb, over our desk, we sat there and Hugh translated it for me. And I wrote, I wrote what he was translating. And he translated a few words. You couldn't do it in one evening, but he translated some of the pages, and I wrote down what he was saying. And then it was just absolutely obvious. And immediately obvious that this was a person that we should love, that the diary shouldn't burn and shouldn't be destroyed. And very quickly the idea that somehow or another this diary needs to go home to the family, just came out. I mean, it was obvious that the family needed the diary back.
You were still a soldier. How did it make you feel reading and coming to know and feeling so personal about someone who was clearly a communist Viet Cong physician and on the other side?
Well, if you read the words, sir, anybody that reads them must come to feel very affected by Dong Thuy Tram. As far as there being, there's many types of love, and you would love Dong Thuy Tram as a brother for a sister. She was an enemy combatant. I never hated any Vietnamese. I never hated anybody that I killed. It was, it was a wartime situation. And we had been taught, as a soldier, that these were godless, heartless people. They had no care for humanity or whatever. And, you know, that belied a lot of that propaganda that I went to Vietnam with. But I wasn't, you know, my concern was I was saving something I shouldn't have. And instead of, and I've explained to a Communist Party meeting in Quang Ngai back in 2005, you don't tell your commanding officer you've fallen in love with an enemy soldier.
Right.
It's just not done, and, you know, they might send you back to a ward someplace. You know, not a romantic love, but a one human being for another human being.
And you didn't know at that particular point what had come of her, right? You didn't know that she
No, I didn't. In actuality, she was not killed until about 6 months later, on the 22nd of June, 1970, and that's when we received the second diary. And when that diary came in, Hugh, again, was the person that was looking through the documents. There were a number of translators.
I mean, isn't this really a strange coincidence that the same translator gets the second?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds almost unbelievable.
Yes,
it sounds.
Yes, it does. It does, absolutely. It absolutely does. And so there are so many strange circumstances with this diary. So many.
Was she guiding the hand in some way? Was she?
Well,
what do you think?
Those of us that have been engaged by Tui's story, some of us have taken on the expression of being Tui's puppets. You know, I didn't die in Vietnam. I was there 3 years. She handed the diary to an American soldier who took it home. Had it fallen in the jungle, it would have just deteriorated. Her family and my family are very, very much alike. Her mom and my mom, the same age. In fact, her next youngest sister and I were born on the same day in 1947. Both grew up to be scientists. My sister, Dang Thi Phuong Cham, well, taught at Canto University. She has a degree in biology, in botany. So a lot of circumstances that make you think, well, okay, you know, we say laughingly, we're puppets of Tui.
So your translator gets the second edition or the second pieces and then tells you about it. And what do you think? What's going on in your mind at that point?
Well, at that time, you know, we sat and translated it. And in fact, I still have the typed pages I typed in that tent so many years ago. Dong Thuy Tram is a hero in my mind, and she's a hero of the world, like Anne Frank. And she needs to be returned to her family. She needs to be returned to her country. We all need heroes. And, you know, having a sense for history, I said, this is going to happen. I'll make it happen, even if it means I'm doing something that my command would probably frown on or become very angry at me about.
And you used the name of Anne Frank, and I'm curious, what's the link in your mind between Thuy and Anne Frank?
You know, I've read the diary of Anne Frank, as we all did when we were in high school. Anne Frank was a little girl hiding from oppressors in an attic. Dang Thuy Tram was a young woman hiding from oppressors and invaders in an attic, but the attic was the jungles up in the Bato jungle. And she wrote beautifully, as did Anne Frank. She bared her soul to this book, as did Anne Frank. And, you know, for so many years, when I've talked to people about this, that's the way I've described it. This is Anne Frank, but from the other side.
So you take the journal home
yeah.
to the U.S., and you're in the U.S. for a number of years, and really nothing happens with the journal.
Well, when I first got home, I had it translated. One of the gentlemen that had worked with me in Vietnam, he had married a woman from Hanoi who had immigrated to the United States, I think, in the 1950s or 60s. And she translated the diary, and I gave that rough translation. It was pretty rough, but I gave it to my mother, who coincidentally just strangely said, "Be careful of this, Fred. It will burn you." Having no idea that Win Trung Hugh had said there was fire in it. That was my mother's words after she read that. And
why did your mother think that it would burn you? What was she saying?
Well, you know, there was a war going on. I had taken it
without permission.
Without permission, probably against somebody's edict. And also
Regulation 14507C3.
Whatever it was, yes, you know, no, don't do that. And you know, the propaganda value during the Vietnam War, as everyone knows, there was a very large vocal group of people in this country who didn't think the war should be going on, and the propaganda value there would have really, you know, brought fire down on me. It would have.
And I, Fred.
Well, yes, sure, and you know, I've heard some of that since the diaries come out too, but I really
still
don't care. Yes, sure. There are Americans that are still bitter. They saw what I saw, and there's Vietnamese who left Vietnam. They're called the Viet Q, and they have a reason to be bitter. They lost their homes and their futures, and they've been through unmitigated horror as boat people or whatever, and they're very bitter. And seeing this person, Dong Thuy Trom, come out as a hero in the eyes of the world leaves them unhappy, and they've expressed their unhappiness to me and their bitterness to me. But, you know, the diary then sat quietly for years and years.
How long did it sit quietly?
Well, it sat quietly, and it stayed with this friend of mine. He's an attorney, and I thought that was the best place for it to be. Until about the early 1990s.
So 20-some years.
Yes, well, I had joined the FBI in between. You know, I came home from war with a lot of issues that war brings home to people. You know, some guys get PTSD, and I think I brought home a bunch of it. But I still, you know, I never forgot the diary. And my older brother, Robert, who's been very instrumental in all of this, he never forgot it. He was in Vietnam with me, and I showed it to him. You know, I went down to visit him in the Mekong Delta. But in the early 1990s, I began to feel like it's time. This has come out, and everybody I went to, they were impressed with it. They fell in love with this lady. My brother translated it. They thought this was so beautiful. But how do we find the family to return? You know, how do we find the family to return the diaries? I went to the media, you know, the stuff you talked about, the FBI, the media followed me for a while. Every time they did, I would hold the diaries up and say, what about this? This is more important, you know. This is a story. I went to Hollywood, you know, I went to journalists. It never caught hold. And then in about the middle 1990s, maybe 96, 97, Rob got an interest, my older brother. And he's a Vietnamese linguist. His wife is from the Mekong. She's Vietnamese. And he started being a partner in this. And then pretty soon, Rob, he had the bug already, but he almost developed an obsession. We've got to translate. We've got to find this lady. It didn't.
And still believing that she was alive.
You know, I knew. What happened in 1970 when she was killed was that was in June. In October, I was on an operation out in the Bato jungle, and I sat down with a guy, and he started telling me about this strange skirmish they'd had. And he described to me the death of Dong Thuy Trom. She was killed by an American unit after they told her to you know, surrender, and finally, and she returned fire. That was the story he told me. But I wasn't sure, you know, maybe it was somebody else, but I was the one where all the documents went through, and that document was in a leather bag, like an over-the-shoulder purse that was handmade. And, you know, all that time I said, this lady is dead, but how do you find the family?
How do you find a ghost?
Yes. Well, you know, it's strange. About 4 years ago, I went on the internet and I typed in her name, and by golly, I found there's somebody named Dong Thuy Trom in the world. It turned out to be a young Vietnamese student in Singapore, and she and I have become good friends because I called her professor in Singapore from North Carolina and asked if he would ask her to contact me, and we've become good friends. She's not any relation. She's a brilliant young student, but there is no Dong Thuy Trom out there. That I'm aware of, other than this young lady. And so Rob hit the internet. He just aggressively went after trying to assist me to find the family. And he found the Vietnam archives at Texas Tech University in I guess 2003, 4, what was it? No, it was about 2004. And, I was afraid to let the diaries go. If you give diaries to somebody, they say, oh, so what? They don't read it. They put it in a box in a corner, and nobody finds out about it. No, I can't get it to the family. So what I did was I sent some other things I had from the war to them. And in March 2005, I went out, and they had preserved these things as if they were something out of an Egyptian tomb or something.
They had preserved objects.
The other objects, some chisels I brought home with me that I found in a field of combat, some documents, some things like that. And they treated them with so much respect. And when I went to the conference and I saw that, I had the diaries with me, and I was going to tell people what had happened. And we had also scanned the diaries and made 10 copies on a CD-ROM. Well, I decided at that point, I'm 50-some years old. Something may happen to me. The diaries will end up in a dumpster someplace. They need to be in an archive. And so at that point, I turned the diaries over to the Vietnam Archives and at Texas Tech University. And Steve Maxner is the director there. His crew took over. And at the same time, during the lecture, I passed out these copies of the CD-ROM of the, that had the diary on them. A number of people were returning to Vietnam, and one of those people was an American vet from the Vietnam War named Ted Engelman. And Ted, 3 days later, was in Hanoi. And, it's really a beautiful story. My brother was taking me to the airport after the conference over with, and he said, Fred, I bet in 30 days we're going to find the family. Oh, by golly.
You did?
My big brother's always right. And within 30 days, Ted Engelman, and with help from a young woman by the name of Anne, found the family. And then it just mushroomed like a thermonuclear love. It was just beautiful. Imagine the image of a Vietnamese woman whose daughter was killed by the brigade that I was with, adopting me and my brother as sons of the family. And paper adoption is one thing. Mother Trump adopting us, we are and consider ourselves true sons of that family.
And so you went to Vietnam at what point, and you met the family?
Yes.
And what was it?
My family.
Met your family. And what was that like?
I cried for 10 days. I mean, everywhere we went, we were just overwhelmed. There was a large entourage of people everywhere we went to.
This was in Hanoi?
Hanoi and Quang Nai and everywhere. And people recognized us. We were on national television. In the media, the Prime Minister, Pham Van Khai, welcomed us to Vietnam.
How did her mother feel about reclaiming a portion of her life that she really had not known about? So clearly it's written in the diary.
And they didn't know. Dong Thuy Trom had written gentle letters home. They had no idea of the horror that she lived.
Of the fierceness also of her.
They had no idea of what she was living through. And nobody did. And sir, this is Thuy's pulling her puppets. A month before the diary showed up, a journalist, a newspaper writer, wrote a story about in the Hanoi paper, trying to get anybody that knew anything about Dong Thuy Trom to come forward, because there was kind of a low-level legend about her. She was a hero of the revolution, of the liberation is what they call it. And it was a no-story story. So a month before Ted Engelman presented the CD-ROMs, they thought, well, we're not going to find anything. And then this strange thing, the diaries come full circle around from an American GI, a man from the invaders who saved those diaries and returned them home as they should have been returned. That's... in about June of 1969, in her diary, she says, if I should not live through this war, take my words to my mother. And it's something to that effect. I'm not quoting her exactly. And there it is.
And so you took the words to her mother.
All of those years later, my brother and I did exactly that. I I guess a lot of GIs that saw combat, you know, walk around as full clinical examples of PTSD. And me in Vietnam was, I wasn't going to go there unless my big brother went, frankly. And Rob was down in the Mekong, so he didn't have a lot of the combat, you know, the vulgar experience of the war. And everywhere I went, things, you know, it was just, it all came rushing back. But the family was so, so loving. So, you know what? That's beyond a fairy tale, that a mother would adopt sons who had essentially been of the army that killed her daughter. That is in her. You know, she loved Thuy Tram, but everybody that knew her loved her, and everybody that will come to know her will love her.
It was a story. It was quite a phenomenon in Vietnam when the book broke, wasn't it? What do you think people connected with the most?
You know, what the journalist told me when I was there was that before Thuy, most of what was written was about heroism and courage and not about the actual guts of the war, the horror of the war, the monotony of the horror of the war. And Bao Dan wrote Sorrow of War, and, you know, that was a beautiful piece. But Thuy Tram connected with people who they knew what they were seeing in the literature wasn't what they had experienced. What Thuy Tram put out was what people experienced. And despite that horror, they are a nation of poets and artists and good people. And they kept that character about them despite the horror that we rained down upon them for how many years? For 20 years?
You know, this early next week in early June, the president of Vietnam is to come to the U.S., visit the White House. What do you think of that, and what would Dong Chuy Tram think of that?
You know, she is a person who loved, and the Vietnamese people love. They forgive. And I think that she would very much approve of that, very much.
Fred, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're more than welcome, sir.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.